You're listening to one in a series of podcasts from the 2009 High Ed Web Conference in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
So the idea I had for this presentation, or the reason I had the idea for this presentation, is in the last year at my job at the University of Rochester, I work in the communications office as the web editor there, and I've been asked to give presentations to several different groups on campus about this social media thing. Could you talk to our department? Could you talk to our faculty? Could you talk to et cetera about Twitter? You manage the university's Facebook page. Come and talk to us about it. So I've given presentations to our board of trustees, our president's cabinet, and the college deans, basically trying to give an overview about what all this stuff is for those audiences. And in the process of doing that, I kind of landed on a few, helpful strategies to kind of help you talk to that group of people about these tools. Like I said, I work in the communications office. Does anyone else here work in a communications or a PR or a marketing shop? Anyone else from IT, web services, organizations? How about admissions or alumni or advancement? Well, so we come from different places, but unless there are some chancellors or chairman of the board of trustees in the room, I think one thing we all have in common is that we all have a boss. We all have a director or a VP or a chair. We need to at least convince or persuade when we have an idea to do something that idea is worth their time and our time. And in social media, there are a few immediate obstacles that you have to overcome before you can even begin to have that conversation. And I'm gonna pick on Twitter a little bit, but I'm really kind of talking about social media in general. When I put this presentation together, I tried another little experiment because I'm not experimental enough, I guess. And I just wrote all my presentations as tweets. So it is supposed to look like that. They're all little tweets. So for Twitter specifically, the first obstacle you need to overcome is that for your audience of your boss, your director, your chair, Twitter is pretty easy to mock. It's called Twitter, number one. It has all kinds of nomenclature that kind of comes around along for the ride. You have to talk seriously in meetings about tweets and retweets and at mentions and DMs and twibbins and twibes and twallows and tweeple and and tweckling and hashtags. And yeah, so the nomenclature just explodes. And it's very easy to find that kind of stuff ridiculous. So if you Twitter, does that make you a twit or a tweeter? All the quotes in this presentation are direct quotes from people that I work with, said to be funny. Are you a twit or a tweeter? I get this in every meeting from one particular colleague who shall remain nameless. So Lori, tell us what's going on in my face and Facebook and Twitter. Ha ha ha. The second obstacle you need to overcome before you can even really begin this conversation is that they know that these things exist, but they don't know, which is kind of dangerous because they think they know. They've heard about it. A tipping point with Twitter specifically about maybe 6, 7, 8 months ago, when CNN is talking about Republicans using Twitter on the House floor during the Barack Obama's speech, when they're writing about it in the New York Times, these people are smart people. They work in higher ed, so they've heard of Facebook, they've heard of Twitter. Not to overgeneralize, but for the most part, they're not using it, so they don't really know. They think they know, but they don't know. And the first two obstacles kind of go hand in hand, right? Because we mock what we don't understand. We sort of inoculate ourselves against embarrassment by immediately making fun of something. That quote about the Facebook and the tweeter, the guy who said that actually honestly slipped up one day and said Facebook at a meeting, and it was kind of funny, and everybody went, ha, ha, ha. So now at the beginning of every meeting, when it gets to my turn to sort of report on my activities, he says, so Lori, what's up on Facebook and my face? So he's kind of inoculating himself against the fact that he doesn't know what these things are. And, you know, he's an associate VP, and it's not comfortable to admit that you're not sure what someone on your staff is doing for a living. So for these folks, trying to get them to understand how the things actually work beyond just simply knowing about it and reading it is another huge challenge. Twitter is a little bit to blame for this, because when Twitter first launched, you know, it had this nice friendly sign that said, "What are you doing?" So I get this all the time from my boss, like, "I'm brushing my teeth, I'm eating my pizza, who cares? Why would I even bother with this stuff?" Trying to then convince them that that's not what it's about is kind of job one. That on Twitter, you're not simply sending out voluminous blasts, although sometimes it feels like that, especially today, or these last few days, about your day-to-day mundane activities. It's not really what are you doing. It's what are you doing, what are you thinking, what are you reacting to, what are you responding to, what are you finding, what are you knowing, what are you learning right now? And sharing all that with those of you who, or those of us who care to listen. So I don't care that, you're right, I don't care that you're eating your pizza, but that's not what it's about. Obstacle number three, to justify your existence or to justify your activities, you're often asked to quantify. And this is kind of a bummer, actually, because I don't like quantifying things. I'm one of those folks that, it's about the conversation. How do you measure the value of a relationship? And what's been great about this conference is I've gone to a couple different sessions that have actually talked about analytics and metrics, so now I've learned more about how to answer this question by attending other people's sessions. But it is kind of challenging to put especially a monetary value, and these folks kind of often think in terms of monetary values and budgets, on what you're doing. For example, at this conference, we've all, I think, kind of witnessed the value of the back channel, and that it's, well, maybe not all of us, maybe there's a few people that wish they didn't experience the value of the back channel. But how do you, and it makes the conference a completely different experience. It's a different level on which to experience the event that we're all physically at. And it adds, I think, a huge value to the experience of the conference. I have no idea how to quantify that. I don't know how much that's worth. It's all of us are the ones that are contributing to it, so in a sense it's free. It's not really free, but it feels free. So how do you put a dollar sign on that? I don't know that you can, and you kind of have to talk to folks who are used to having dollar signs on everything in a way that doesn't put a financial value on things necessarily right up front. So that's a challenge. And the last challenge, shouldn't you be working? This is they've heard about Facebook specifically from students, and it's a place where you go and goof around and socialize, and now you're telling your boss that you're going to sit in your office and be on Facebook, and it's work. It's not chatting with your friends. Oh my gosh, I'm sorry. My voice is going. The flip side of that, though, is you also have to convince them that, or explain to them, that just because there's a fun factor, there's a play factor in places like Facebook and Twitter that can't be discounted. And just because something is fun doesn't mean it's not real and useful and valuable as a tool. So when I'm on Facebook, yeah, sometimes I'm checking out my friends' movie picks and bands and stuff, but I'm not just doing that, and I'm actually not even mostly doing that. It's not a tool for fun, but it's got a fun element to it that you can't just dismiss. You can't dismiss the fact that these things are fun. That's kind of the point. If you're not having fun with them, you're not helping build the community. So when you're sitting in your office trying to use these things, you just need to make sure that your boss understands that this isn't fun and games. It's fun and work. There we go. Let me back up for a second. So to overcome all of these obstacles, you need, I think, a few strategies. You need to sort of figure out, what can I do to kind of break down those doors? The first thing you really kind of have to do with these folks, I think, is convince them that this stuff is real. It's not a fad. It's not a trend. To quote a friend of mine, this isn't Santa Claus. I didn't make this up. This is real. This exists. And for this audience, statistics can sometimes be a useful tool. These are folks, remember, who, again, they're smart people. They probably remember the dot-com boom and bust of the 90s. They'd be forgiven for thinking that something called Twitter is just the next pets.com and is going to be consigned to the sock puppet dustbin of history. And it's easily ignored. Excuse me. But it's your job to convince these folks that this is real, that this isn't going away. And to do that, statistics can be useful door openers with this group. This is a group that likes to see things, like I said, quantified and quantifiable. Statistics aren't the end-all and be-all, but they at least help you get that initial "this isn't a fad" conversation started. So this is a slide that I've used in a couple of the presentations I was talking to you about earlier to try to help explain the reality of a site, in this case, Facebook. This was done back in March, and at the time, Facebook had just turned 5 years old. It had 175 million active users. 99% of incoming freshmen have a Facebook profile. That's according to a study from the College of Amherst. There were 300,000 new users being added every day, and our University of Rochester Facebook fan page there had 4,300 fans. Now, if I were to give this presentation today, I'd have to update that slide in a professional manner, of course. 6-7 months later, Facebook is now 5.5 years old with 300 million active users. The 99%, I'm assuming, hasn't changed. I haven't seen any updates on that about college freshmen. 600,000 new users added every day, and our page is now up to 5,600. When I gave this presentation to the board at their retreat in Niagara Falls, which was very nice, I got to go to Niagara Falls, this 175 million active user figure put Facebook, if Facebook were a country, it would be the sixth most populated country on Earth. More than Russia, more than Japan, more than Pakistan, more than Bangladesh. And folks around the room were kind of like, really, really? Really? And today, 300 million, if Facebook were a country, it would be the third most populous country on Earth, behind only the United States and China. So it's not an insignificant ephemeral thing that's going away. It's actually got this critical mass of folks using it. So once you've kind of convinced them, or at least helped explain to them that these things are real and around and aren't a fad, the next thing I think you need to do, because again, for the most part, these folks aren't using these tools, although they've heard of them, is show them the conversation. It's much easier to show than it is to tell. Let them see the conversation happening. We don't think about conversations as visual, but in this case, they kind of are. You want to let them see the conversation for themselves. So again, this is another slide from a presentation I've done for, in this case, the Board of Trustees. So when I open with this slide, I have, this is me on Facebook. I haven't had a Simpsons avatar in a really long time, and I haven't had that hair in a really long time. That's kind of, or that office, for that matter. I've moved around. So this always gets a little bit of a chuckle. And then the next thing I do right from here is log in live to Facebook, you know, in the boardroom with all the trustees and people sitting around, just say, well, let's just log in as me and see what's going on. And again, make a kind of joke about, hope my friends aren't up to anything naughty. Ha ha ha. And then silently actually really hope that my friends aren't up to anything really naughty. And log in and then let them see. The sort of light bulb moment for them is you start to explain, and it's very basic stuff, but you start to explain in simple, non-Facebook-specific or Twitter-specific language what's going on here. So I log in as me, and the first thing I see is my friend in San Francisco who has a film opening this week is going to a film festival. My sister has posted pictures of her cousin's or our cousin's wedding from last weekend. The band that I'm following has a new album out or a new concert. The library, the university library, for example, has posted something. So you see all of these status updates. And the first question they ask is, so when one of your friends puts something on there, you just see it? Like, yes, see, they're all there. So if you wrote something right now, all your friends would see it? Yes, they would. So it's kind of at that level, and you can't sort of talk to them, and I'm being kind of cynical and sarcastic because I'm with you all, and we all like each other. But for that group, you really have to be kind of, have a sort of an educational tone to your voice, I think, and not kind of act like you're simplifying things. But it is very basic, and it's exciting to kind of see folks who maybe haven't experienced this to sort of start to see the value of it. It's fun, you know, their little light bulbs go off, and it's kind of a cool thing to experience. Whoops, I skipped ahead, sorry. The other thing I do once we log in and sort of see everything or log into my profile is, and if you haven't done this yourself, you should, and if you haven't done it with your boss, you should, start doing a search for your university on these different tools. Trying to convince them that the university needs to be a player in Facebook and Twitter and YouTube, for example, will be a lot easier if you sort of show them that the conversation is happening anyway. It's happening without us if we're not part of it. And we want to be part of it. We want to be able to contribute. So on Facebook, for example, if you our institutional Facebook page is just one really small aspect of our university's presence on Facebook. We have groups out the wazoo. We've got dozens of groups for the University of Rochester. If you nail two things together that have never been nailed together before, someone will make a Facebook group out of it. We have groups for specific floors and specific dorm rooms, history majors, senior history majors, each a cappella group, all the athletics teams, just people who hate the woman who works in the dining services area, not naming any names. In our university, University of Rochester is often confused with Rochester Institute of Technology. So we have several Facebooks that say Rochester is not, Facebook groups that say Rochester is not RIT, Rochester's better than RIT, RIT is better than Rochester. We've got RIT colleagues in the house. On YouTube, thank goodness we have several a cappella groups that have really good YouTube channels, because if you do a search for University of Rochester on YouTube, the first 25 things you see are their videos. Not the communications office's videos, because their videos get viewed a whole lot more than ours do, and they're great. In this case, when I did a search for University of Rochester with the group, the board, there is a student that posted a video of him playing the Harry Potter theme on our University Carillon. And it was awesome. It's like, and everyone's laughing, like, that's one of our students. Like, yeah, that is. And he posted it on YouTube. Yes, he did. That's great. And the same thing on Twitter. You can use Twitter search tools just to see what are people, I mean, we've been doing it probably quite a bit at this conference. What are people saying about the University of Rochester? Create a sort of a search panel. If you use a product called TweetDeck, for example, you can track all your searches and sort of see moment to moment what people are saying about you on Twitter. So it's that sort of listening second step beyond just sending things out. And once they get to see that all this stuff is kind of going on anyway, and you don't have anything to do with it at the moment, they may feel a little bit differently about how they want to participate. And this is the point at which your boss may start to get scared when you start to show him that all the, him or her that all these things are happening. You may have to talk them back from the edge at this point and convince them that it's not about control, it's about authenticity. For this group of people, that's probably an obvious message, a message we've talked about a lot at this conference, but for this group of people, it's not their comfort zone. Especially if you're talking about people in PR, communications, and marketing, these are the folks who are used to driving the message and creating the message and crafting the message and distributing the message. To explain to them that the fact that they have no control over what's going on is a good thing, is a difficult thing to do. So the next thing I think you need to do with these folks, you've talked to them about why this is real, you've given them some statistics and background, you've shown them a little demo logging in, for example, let them go for a test drive. Let them steer for a while. If they're not on Facebook, maybe help them create a Facebook page or a Twitter page, and let them kind of see this stuff for themselves and the power of it for themselves, because it's not really, it doesn't really come home, it doesn't really hit home until you actually start to experience it. So for example, this is our engineering school dean, and he created a Twitter page for himself over the summer. He's a new dean, and we have a new, in our office, we have writers and publicists who cover different beats in the university, and we had a new engineering publicist who's a younger guy, and we have a new dean, and they kind of talked, and he said, you should really try this out, and if it doesn't work, but you should try it out. So Dean Clark is on Twitter, and this is one of the first things he tweeted from his account. The first student to call our office will receive a University of Rochester banner and a decal. This kind of cracked me up because the thing he asked someone to do was to call a phone number. Like, he didn't say, say hello or retweet this, or he's like, call me. Okay. Less than a minute. There's the next slide. So that was Dean Clark's reaction. And I don't know who called. I don't know if it was a staff member or a student or a faculty member, but someone who, I mean, he had been on Twitter for like a week. People were already following him, obviously, because they saw that that message and replied in less than a minute. So I'm going to try to do, this is going to be a little challenging, I apologize. I'm going to try to do a little demo of my own. How do you Mac people do this? This is something you may have seen. If you're on Twitter a lot, you may have seen people doing where they're doing a demo for some new person, someone who's new to Twitter. I thought I was logged in. Okay. Yeah, what's everybody up to today? So they do, if you have someone who's never seen Twitter in action before and you're trying to explain to them how this can work, one aspect of it, you can do a quick demo of Twitter for them. And I'm going to do a demo of how to do a demo of Twitter for your boss right now. So, doing a demo of how to do, thank you. Are you my spell checker, Deb? Of how to do a demo of Twitter for your boss. Someone say hi, please. Think. Ah, thank you. Yes, you do have to explain hashtags. Where is it? There we go. But it'll get found better. So I'm going to let that steep for a while and come back. Yeah, let's see. Hey, co-chair extraordinaire. Hey there, co-chair extraordinaire. Steve in the back of the room. I know. Oh, what network are you on back there? He saw that coming. Oh, of course, Matt Hershberger. I'll have to do this again, and then people will just be like, hello already, go away. But this is a very simple but powerful way, I think, to show someone who has never used Twitter themselves how it starts conversations and how people respond back and forth on kind of an individual level and on a more specific kind of tactile level. And then from there, they might be able to start to imagine how something like a university as an institution, or I get asked sometimes about, you know, who can have a Facebook page, who can have a Twitter page. In my opinion, any unit of the university that can sustain it and manage it and thinks it's useful and has an idea about how to do it should do it. If the English department wants a Twitter page, go for it. If the department, if the faculty member in the English department, if one class in the English department wants a Twitter page so that they can talk to each other during the semester, why not? If it works, if it's something that they think they can sustain and find value from, why not? So this is a way to show those groups in real time how Twitter might actually be applied to what they're doing. Let me see if I've got any more people, and then I'll go back. I had a lot more yesterday, but it's okay. Everybody's sleepy. Oops. You get to relive the presentation. I'm reliving it, so you might as well relive it. So this kind of gets to what I was just saying about, you know, who should have a Facebook page or a Twitter page. The question of, do we need to have a strategy of how we're going to do this, of what we're going to try to get out of it and why we're doing it, or should we just do it? It's kind of a tricky question to answer. And in my experience, they're not mutually exclusive. First, you just do it. Then you have a strategy. I think you can't get bogged down or try to think about all the eventualities or permutations of what a Twitter page might do for you or a Facebook page might do for you without just doing it first. The university's institutional Twitter or university Facebook page that I and some other folks at the university manage, for lack of a better word, I created that on the day that pages were announced as a feature with no clue about what I was going to do with it. The main reason I created it was because I wanted to make sure that someone who worked for someone, admissions or communications or some office, had control of the University of Rochester name before somebody else grabbed it. I didn't have a plan about what I was going to do with it. I was just kind of squatting on it at that point. Similar thing with Twitter, where we just wanted to have the U of R name before we really knew what we were going to do with it. But then from there, you can start trying to plan, as you sort of go through trial and error, the things that work and the things that don't work, and do some experimentation. So for example, after this conference last year, and really seeing the beginnings of the power of what Twitter can do with a group that has this sort of geographic proximity, I call it, that we all have now, we're all geographically proximate. We're all here at an event together, face to face. And we're all meeting people, and we're all doing the same thing in the same place. That's a great place to start to see Twitter interact. I mean, that's where it was first created. It was at a kind of a conference at South by Southwest, where everyone was kind of together in one place. You can start to see that when people have geographic proximity, they want to keep in touch virtually as well. They want to know what's going on over here and what's going on over there, and where are you and what are you doing? If you do that with a group or with an event at your own campus, just as an experiment, just call it a pilot program if that helps make it more palatable, just to see what happens, like commencement or a reunion weekend. Like last year at this conference coincided with our big, we call it Melior Weekend. That's our big reunion family parent day. And I just thought, oh, this would be so much fun at Melior Weekend. The demographic is probably right. We've got a lot of the young alumni, maybe a lot of young professionals that I think would get a lot out of this. So this year, Melior Weekend is this weekend coming up. So we have a bunch of people in our young alumni office and our advancement office, communications office, who are kind of, they created a separate Melior Weekend Twitter page. We have the university's institutional Twitter page. The individuals are tweeting as themselves using a hashtag, Meliora. We put the hashtag on the registration materials when you sign up for the weekend. I don't know if they were smart enough to put it on the name badges or not, but that would have been cool. I'm not sure. But we tried to promote this idea of a hashtag. And we don't know what's going to happen. I mean, obviously, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, look what happened here. But it could be great. I'm sure there will be positive elements of it and negative elements of it. But we, as the university, will be providing another channel, another layer, another form of experience of that event that wouldn't exist without it. It might be great. It might do nothing. But it's something to try. It's something to experiment with. And then lastly, if you're trying to convince your boss that this thing called Twitter is a good thing to do, maybe instead of taking it at the institutional level and saying we need a university Twitter page or a Facebook page, think about how you and your colleagues can use it on the sort of personal and professional level. What about your own social media presence, not just your institutions? So if you work in a PR office, for example, are the individual people who work in that office on Twitter, and are they using it for professional purposes? In PR, there are a couple of resources. Muckrack is a good one for finding journalists on Twitter, just finding reporters who are on Twitter. There's a service called Help a Reporter Out, which started off as an email, I believe, and is now on Twitter, where they just send out, if a reporter needs a source to talk about the coming crisis in university admissions at small liberal arts colleges, I need a source to talk to me by 4 p.m. for my deadline. If you have a legitimate person at your campus that can speak to that, you can get in touch with that person over Twitter and get your PR, media relations job done through Twitter. So kind of thinking about your personal space as also your professional space. The personal is professional. If you can figure out, or if you can get your institution or your boss around that idea of doing it individually, it might be a little easier. Once they see it in action in their own office, it might be a little easier to kind of get them up to that institutional level. I say every day, and this kind of gets back, and this definitely gets back to that, you know, shouldn't you be working obstacle. If you can show, I tell my boss all the time, like, I learn something new on Twitter every day that helps me do my job. I also learn that, you know, someone's going bowling and someone's been out till 3 o'clock in the morning and eating pancakes. But that's the fun element. Just because something's fun doesn't mean it's also not useful. As a professional development tool, for me, it's been amazing. I follow all you guys, and I hear what you're doing, and I see what you're doing, and I hopefully contribute something every now and again. And it's a give and take, and you learn, you know, while you're sitting at your desk, basically. I've heard so many things first by hearing them on Twitter. And this slide just says what I just said. I should have skipped ahead. Experiment with ways to use Twitter in your own profession. And so if you work in PR, are you following the local reporters and the local media in your area on Twitter? They're all out there. Every hour in Rochester, every local television market has an institutional Twitter page, and most of the reporters have their own pages. We had a suspicious package alert on campus that actually turned out to be one of our faculty members shipping a riding crop back from Africa. And it had wires sticking out of it. It had some sort of weird wires coming out of it. And it got stopped in our campus mail services office because, oh, there's a box with wires sticking out of it. And the people, the reporter, they closed down traffic. They called the bomb squad out. And we had two reporters on Twitter saying, what's going on at U of R? There's something happening with the security. I'm going to go check it out. And if a reporter in the old days of last year, the first contact you'd probably have with a reporter about something like that would be them calling you and saying, there must be something up at U of R. Can you talk about it yet? And then your university spokesperson meets with her boss and has a message, and what are we going to tell them and when? You can't do that anymore. You can't wait. They're going to be talking about it themselves anyway. It's just like if they called you. It's just now their first contact is on Twitter. So if you can sort of show those kind of professional uses of Twitter on a personal level for you, for your job, I think that can help make the case for we need to be doing this at an institutional level that makes sense for us. I think this is my last slide. And this is my last slide, and then we'll open up for some discussion. This is a slide that I've ended a couple presentations with for these folks to sort of try to help them understand what the point is of all of this and why we're doing this. So I had to talk about the line. We need to participate, not dominate. So often we'll have, for example, our friend who played the Harry Potter theme on the Carillon. Had thousands of hits, very cool, 45-second video. So the reaction is sort of, hey, this amazing, spontaneous, serendipitous thing just happened. Let's do it again. Let's make a viral video. And I don't know how you make a viral video. You make a video, and it becomes viral because good things happen to it. And maybe maybe I'm just not sophisticated enough to think about how you would manipulate things and make them go viral. But you can't, you know, bottle lightning and have it happen again. You have to just sort of let these things happen. And again, for folks, that get, especially in PR, whose job it is to kind of push things out and get things to happen because they want them to, this concept can be a little tricky. That the value of it is the fact that it is authentic, that it has its own origin, and you didn't push it. And if you start to, it gets obvious really quickly that you're kind of, the PR office is pushing out all of this viral stuff, and aren't we great? You need to step back a little bit. The fact that the reason that video was so cool is because our office had nothing to do with it. If our office did have something to do with it, it wouldn't have looked at all like it looked like, and it wouldn't have been nearly as compelling to anybody. Institutions need to find their feet in this virtual world and learn to contribute, not control. I think that's kind of the role of people like us, the institutional side of things. I liken our Facebook page to a party. We're throwing a party, and as the host of the party, we want the individuals who attend the party to have a great time and to talk to each other. That's why they're there, is to talk to each other. We're providing the cocktails and the snacks. We're providing them with stuff that they can't get anywhere else. That's that last point. Above all, be useful. Give them something they can use, do, or have fun with, something they can't get from anyone else, and then get out of the way. So we do produce great stuff. We produce videos. We have news. We have events. We have stuff that we know about because we work in the communications office. We can provide that information, that fodder, to people. And they probably can't get that information from a better source. But our job after that is just to get out of the way. And we've had some cases where, and only twice, actually, there's only been twice on our institution's Facebook page history that I've deleted anything, and both times they were spam. That was just someone posted an ad for something that had absolutely nothing to do with Rochester or the University of Rochester, so I just zapped it. But we get all kinds of comments to things that we post, people liking and commenting on things. We had a couple of examples where this gets back to that... your boss might get a little scared. We had a couple of cases where the boss did get a little bit scared and said, you know, ooh, what should we do? What should we do? One was we were mentioned in an article, one of these rankings. It wasn't really a real ranking, but it was just like the top 10 blah. We were the top 10 best schools, best prices, or good schools, good prices. So someone in the admissions office posted that to our Facebook page. The University of Rochester is a good school. The University of Rochester is a great school. I don't know anyone who would say it has a good price or is cheap in any way. So they posted that to the Facebook page, and immediately we had like 4 or 5, and then by the end of the day, 15 or 16 comments saying exactly that. You know, this is a great place and everything, but I don't know where they're getting this good prices thing because you guys are pretty expensive. And that kind of comment trail started rolling along. And in our office, the first reaction from the guy who said the Facebook and the MyFace thing was, well, you can delete that, right? You can just leave the post there and delete the comments, or could you just delete some of the comments or delete the whole thing? I was like, no, it's out there, and they're not saying anything incorrect. They're all coming from a place of love. You know, they're all fans of the university. They wouldn't be fans of the university's page if they weren't fans of the university. And they're making legitimate points. I mean, why would we axe that? So instead, our director of admissions, who is on Facebook, wrote a little like one sentence response about, you know, yeah, fair point. We don't know how these lists are put together either. We have some high percentage of our students get financial aid, and that's probably why we ranked highly. You should check out our financial aid pages for more details. And just a sort of a friendly, simple tone. And that was it. And nothing else happened after that. The second one was a little funnier. We had our students they won the College Bowl, that old TV quiz, the College Bowl. We had the College Bowl champions on our campus. And they became the phone-a-friend folks for Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. So they were on Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And they had this video that they were running on all the networks for a week. So we posted that video to our Facebook page. And you know how it picks out a little icon and it just slaps it on there, and you have a limited control over what icon it gets put? The little icon that got put up was just this sort of blue box that didn't really look like anything. It was a logo for the show, I guess. And the feedback immediately, the first person who commented said, oh, why does that remind me of a Tampax box? And then we had 8 comments about Tampax boxes. Nothing bad, just being goofy, just being funny. And the guy who posted it was like, you know, this is fantastic. This was such a fantastic opportunity, and we wasted it because these stupid people are talking about Tampax boxes. Let's delete it and do it again. Let's delete it and repost it. And I was like, no, they're just having a conversation with themselves. It's nothing bad with the university. It didn't work out as well as we wanted it to, but you have to take the rough with the smooth. You have to take the good with the bad. So the line here is all about authenticity and what are your people really saying, learning when to contribute to the conversation like our dean of admissions did, and when to step back. It's all about contributing, not controlling. That can be a hard point with these folks, but it's an important point to make before you try to do anything real. I think I'm done. I think I left more time for questions this time. So. Yeah, if that's how you want to use it, that's absolutely how you should use it. And then if they try to friend you, just ignore them, and they'll get the message. I do have professional folks on Facebook, and I kind of think of my Facebook page as more a combination of the fun and professional. There are things I wouldn't put there. And for instance, I actually did have a little bit of a struggle when this Facebook MyFace guy friended me. And I was like, oh, no, he's an associate VP, and he wants to be my friend. Okay. But then I accepted it because I thought, okay, he's trying. This is really hard for him. This is a guy who's not, he doesn't get this at all. And I don't post anything that I wouldn't want him to see anyway, so sure, I'll be his friend. My boss, this guy isn't my boss. He's like my half-boss. It's one of these weird relationships. But my actual real boss hasn't friended me, and I think and I have an employee, and I haven't friended her, because I think when the power relationships are unequal, then it gets weird. We're at the same level in the organization, so I just thought, okay, he's trying, and I need to encourage that. But if you want to use it for personal reasons, that's the use you're putting it to, then you should do that. Yep.
One thing about that is I do that, but I typically the pushback delivery is what I get a lot of time. So I have to check my voicemail
The answer to that is you don't have to respond to a tweet in 5 minutes if that's not how you want to. All of these things are voluntary. They're not mandatory, and they're not. There are tools that can sort of help you use it more efficiently. Like TweetDeck's a big one. I wouldn't show your boss TweetDeck if those of you haven't used it or seen it. It's sort of a panel view of Twitter that it's sort of sensory overload the first time you see it. You see all the different panels sort of moving in space in real time. It does. I have it open on my desk all day. I have my own Twitter account. I have the university's Twitter account. During the conference, I have the conference Twitter account. So I tweet way too much. But I don't think there's any, you're not under any obligation to do any of these things. I think it's interesting and useful to try. And if it doesn't work out for you and if you feel like it's a time suck, just stop doing it. Yeah. Sorry, at the end? Yeah. Mm-hmm. We have had that question. We haven't had that experience yet. But at that Board of Trustees meeting in Niagara Falls, the dean of the School of Nursing, when I was sort of showing how you write things and they appear on other people's pages and people write back and forth, and some of the things people were saying that were kind of funny, she actually said, "I'm sorry, but is all this legal? Are we allowed to just be sharing all this stuff? Is it okay to be sharing this stuff?" And our university general counsel, the lawyer in the room, which was fantastic, said, she's like, "I don't understand any of this. I'm not going to use any of this. I'm not going to do any of this. But from an institutional standpoint, the only thing that I would say that we need to worry about is if someone's making an ad hominem attack on an individual person. And if someone did that, we, as an institution, we need to take care of our people and we need to get that off of there." It's never happened in our experience yet. I'm sure others have had experiences where that may have happened, but not with us. I think I've only got time for one more question. I'm sorry, Jay? Nambu? Yeah, I think the second part, the listening half of the equation of all of this social stuff is the hardest to get. We all know how to write things on the wall and send things out on Twitter, but the flip side of the conversation that involves listening is the one that doesn't come as intuitively. I think the biggest thing that I do all the time that I don't know if it works, but I think it helps, is just simply showing them the conversation that's happening anyway is often an eye-opener. That there's already people talking about us. They'll write things like, "Oh, I'm visiting the University of Rochester with my kids today." We're not going to jump in and reply to or retweet or do anything to like every mention of the University of Rochester. But there have been occasions where you can answer a question someone's having, and then they freak out. They're so excited that you actually responded to them, that someone from the institution said, "Well, actually, the campus visits don't start until March. Go to this URL to sign up." They just are beside themselves with gratitude and joy. So if you can show a couple of instances of that happening, it's a hard sort of thing to click over to. But as you start to see it, I think that's the most useful thing to try. I think I'm out of time. So thanks, everybody.